from WNPR. I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse.
A suicide bomber at rush hour in the New York City subway.
With sexual harassment allegations stirring a national reckoning, three of President Trump's accusers joined together today, saying the man in the Oval Office should also be held accountable.
I just want to set the record straight while they're here. One of our attorneys is a Jew.
Well, I'd rather see the Republican win, but I hope that Republican would be a write-in. I couldn't vote for Roy Moore. I didn't vote for Roy Moore.
Doug Jones, the Democrat, he will be the next United States Senator from Alabama. He beats Roy Moore in this really, really exciting contest. Doug Jones comes from behind. First time in 25 years that a Democrat will be elected senator from the state of Alabama.
If you'd like to join the conversation about the week's news, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. Joining us as always is Colin McEnroe. He's the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, just back from traveling abroad. Good to see you once again, Colin.
Buongiorno.
Buongiorno to you as well. Liz Karanowicz is here. She's Republican political analyst. Hello there once again, Liz.
Good morning.
And welcome to Bilal Sekou, who's associate professor of political science at the University of Hartford. Hello, Bilal. Good to see you.
Good morning.
So there's a lot to talk about, but we've got to start in the state of Alabama in a race that, as we just heard Wolf Blitzer say, was very, very exciting and incredibly close, but not so close that it would trigger a recount. Doug Jones beats Roy Moore in an election, Colin, that probably won't just resonate in Alabama, won't just resonate in terms of 2018 electoral politics, but it's going to resonate in Washington and maybe even places like Connecticut right now. What's your big takeaway from this thing last night?
Well, I think it will and it won't resonate. I mean, I think one thing that we can reasonably say is that there won't be a lot of elections that closely resemble this one anywhere. I'm, as you perhaps know, a Green Bay Packers fan, and last Sunday they beat in a thrilling nail-biter overtime victory the Cleveland Browns. Now, the problem is the Cleveland Browns have not won more than one game in their last 27 attempts, so that's not that great. And in a way, what you're seeing in Alabama, if you're a Democrat, it should make you feel kind of excited, but you were running against basically a child molester. You won a nail-biter of a vote. This is the second time in the last year that the Democrats have had to run against somebody who basically was completely and sordidly and unimpressively underqualified for the office. The other one is the person who won the national election. So they didn't do so well running against the Antichrist the first time around. They ran against the Antichrist this time. They won. Generally, you should be able to beat the Antichrist pretty easily. Obviously, Alabama, the demographics of Alabama are tough. They're tough for Democrats. I think I'll say one more thing because I'm babbling. From a very technical standpoint, those of us who look at this kind of stuff, what we'd say before elections is it all comes down to turnout. And then we watch the election and it turns out that turnout, even though we say that, turnout rarely can overcome a tendency. So let's say that Liz gets a really great candidate to run against, SD or Courtney or Himes. Turnout is probably not going to knock somebody out of a seat like that because it just takes so much more than turnout. Turnout is one factor. I think you might have seen last night an election that was won and swung and overcome on the basis of turnout. You just don't see that often.
Yeah, we were expecting as of yesterday maybe a turnout like you'd see in an awful lot of special elections, not just in Alabama, but anywhere across the country. They were talking about 18% to 25%, and then you have a lot more people turn out, and all of a sudden things do change. Liz, what do you take away from yesterday?
Well, I think special elections are always outliers, right? And in this one in particular, there was a lot of mitigating factors, namely that the candidate running, as Colin so eloquently put, was an accused child molester and pedophile. And so I think, that certainly played a large role in energizing the Democrat turnout and maybe in keeping Republicans home. They didn't want to go vote for Roy Moore. You had a lot of Republicans at the national level running against him for good reason. And that includes the senior senator from Alabama, who was the last Democrat elected senator from Alabama and then switched switched parties. So I think, you know, turnout, look, special elections, you know, you had the forces of the entire national Democrat apparatus pouring into one place. It's funny, I was thinking about this. The last time I was here, we had a conversation about, I remember mentioning the Moore race and the fact that the Real Clear Politics average had it within 4 points, which was largely the margin of error. And the Fox News poll at the time, which I think that was maybe, you know, a month or 6 weeks ago, had them dead even. And this was before the allegations and the accusations came out against him. So it was a close race then, as you might expect in a special election, again, because you have all of the focus of a national apparatus. But it always comes, Bilal and I were having this conversation before, it always comes down to candidate and who's going to energize their base and who's going to turn people out. And clearly, for a lot of reasons, that was in the Democrat favor.
Yeah, and your point being that Roy Moore was an incredibly flawed, damaged candidate before any of the allegations came out.
Yeah.
He's somebody that a lot of Republicans couldn't get energized about in Alabama. National Republicans couldn't get energized to go stump for, certainly. They were turning their backs on him.
Yeah.
So, Bilal, what did you see in all this?
I guess for me, you know, I'd like to look at it probably from about 10,000 feet above. I mean, I think, you know, certainly the hierarchy of sins that Moore committed, you know, being an accused pedophile is certainly at the top. I think Moore as a candidate, for me at least, was very bothersome, not just because of those accusations, but when you go down the list in terms of the misogyny, when you go down the list and you talk about the racism, when you talk about the homophobia, when you talk about the Islamophobia, I mean, there's a long laundry list of things that were really bad about this candidate. And for me at least, the outcome of the election, while I thought it's extraordinary that the Democrats were able to take that seat in the South, it's still closer than it should have been, in my opinion. I think Moore is such a outlier for what is normal politics, or at least what should be normal politics in America, that he never should have been a candidate for the Republican Party ever. But the other takeaway for me about this election was the extraordinary dependence the Democratic Party has on what is essentially its most progressive wing of the party, which is the African American community. And I think this creates a kind of challenge for the Democrats in order to be able to win and to be successful at the national level in presidential races. They need an extraordinarily high turnout by African American voters and other people of color. Regular turnout just won't do it. You really do need the kind of turnout you saw in 2008 and the kind of turnout you saw yesterday, which was record-breaking turnout. Now, the problem that creates with the Democratic Party is that in order to keep that base energized, and African Americans are probably about 30% of the Democratic base in terms of self-identified people, in order to keep them energized, you've got to appeal to their needs and interests. And that's going to be a challenge for the Democrats, because I think it also creates a challenge because for whites in the country, and certainly Trump's election, and I think some of the other challenges around race and other things that go on in our society, and the fact that many whites identify with the Republican Party or are conservative, to appeal to African Americans, to really get them to come out and to support candidates, it may mean that you also have a challenge with keeping many whites energized about the party. And I think that's a problem that the Democrats face.
I heard something interesting on Morning Edition this morning. They were interviewing Tom Perez, who was taking kind of a victory lap around all of the various national programs, and saying that the Democratic apparatus is what turned out this victory. Rachel Martin, who's been spending the week reporting from Alabama, kind of butted in and said, you know, I was on the campaign trail with an awful lot of African Americans who were energizing that vote, and not a one of those organizers were saying they were doing it on behalf of the Democratic Party.
Right. Mm-hmm.
They were doing it on behalf of African Americans in Alabama.
Right. Right.
And just maybe a quick comment from you about that, Bilal. Mm-hmm. It gets to that question we always have about, has the Democratic Party gone far too far in taking that vote for granted and just not listening to what people are saying?
I mean, absolutely. I think in the weeks before the election that there were lots of complaints about the lack of a ground game on the part of the Democratic Party to mobilize the African-American community and taking that vote for granted. And I think at the end of the day, if the Democrats are going to have success, especially at the national level, winning, for example, the White House, they need to have a very energized African-American community that will go out there. So they've got to have, Liz and I were talking about earlier, really great candidates that appeal and excite that base, but also you've got to have a platform and a set of issues that really respond to the needs and interests of that base.
Yeah, I think each party has kind of mirror image problems. So for the Republicans, they won 72% of white male voters and 63% of white female voters, and they lost an election. So that tells you that they've got the mirror image problem, right? That they can do a fabulous job energizing that group of people and still lose an election because, you know, at the end of the 2008 election, Bill Curry said that the Republicans weren't on the wrong side of history. They were on the wrong side of demographics. You know, this is a changing nation, and the complexion of the nation literally is changing. So you got to get the demographics right. But I think Bilal's point is the important one. Getting the demographics right is not enough if you don't have a substantive set of ideas, if you're not talking to those constituencies about what it is you mean and what it is you're planning to do. And you need no further back an example. Then in 2016, Clinton failed to equal Obama's 2012 numbers among Latinos. Think about that. She's running against a candidate who oozes contempt and hostility towards Latinos at an unprecedented level, and she can't get the same numbers that Obama got. To me, that's an example of, you know, you just haven't talked to that constituency in a way that's meaningful. You kind of have to really move up above so-called identity politics and talk reality, talk substance, talk about here's how your lives are going to change.
Okay, so and that's a little bit of the analysis on the Democratic side. They win this, Liz, but there's this question about what does this teach the Democratic Party about how they should be thinking about these elections in the future? Okay, what does it teach us about the National Republican Party? Does it say anything outside of this very crazy election in Alabama? I mean, an awful lot of people in your party are trying to figure out right now, do we continue to align ourselves with Trumpian politics or style that we don't prefer in order to, again, demographically kind of continue this win, this surge that he had in 2016? Or is this a turning point in which people start to say, look, we can't act this way anymore. We have to get back to that bigger tent politics that was hinted at after Mitt Romney's loss last time around?
I think the problem with winning sometimes is that you don't get the chance to sort of do that after action report because you kind of move into the governing phase. And it's one of the frustrations I had with the time that we've been in since the 16 presidential election, because the same problems that existed in 2012 are the same problems that exist for Republicans now, which is that we don't have the compelling message, it seems, for next generation voters. When you look at the turnout yesterday, just on this one example, in the college towns in Alabama, they rightly voted for Doug Jones and against Roy Moore. Those are Republican-leaning college campuses, generally speaking. And so I think when you look at how do we move forward, we have to do a good job at looking at next-generation voters and how are we going to talk about where we move the future of the country and how are we going to build a coalition of the largest growing population of voters, which is the Latino community. And so we need to, and women too. I mean, you know, women and college-educated Republicans voted against Roy Moore yesterday. And you saw that too in Connecticut, for example, in the presidential election. You know, a lot of those folks didn't vote with President Trump, but we built grew a coalition among other folks. So I think, you know, all sides have a lot of work to do in terms of building out, you know, sort of a winning coalition at every level. But as I always go back to the strength of candidate, you need compelling candidates who are going to bring people with them and you know, compel people to go out and knock doors and make phone calls and give donations and things like that. So it really just comes down to the people.
Right. I think you're absolutely right. You know, I teach at a university, and so I see who these millennials are. And what's interesting to me about this, you know, current group of people who are entering the electorate now and becoming more politically engaged and politically active is that this is an incredibly racially and ethnically diverse group of people. In fact, they're the most racially and ethnically diverse, you know, sort of cohort of Americans ever that we've ever seen. What's also interesting about them is that when it comes to issues that often divide us as a nation, issues around same-sex marriage, issues around, you know, other sort of hot-button issues, they are the most tolerant on a lot of those issues. And so I think both parties are faced with a real challenge about how to integrate them into the political system. And again, this goes back to Colin's point, that if you don't speak to the kinds of issues that they care about and are concerned about, you just won't have success motivating them and energizing them to turn out.
Right. Yeah, the last time that the Republicans nationally had, I think, a real hyper-consciousness about this question, oddly enough, was 2000. And so Lee Atwater, the guy who had previously given us the Willie Horton ad, he really tried to mobilize his own party. And the Philadelphia 2000 National Convention was the most multi-ethnic Republican convention ever. And he and sort of the whole George W. Bush contingent, they understood. If you cannot motivate Latino voters, if you can't find African-American people with a reason to vote Republican, you're going to start losing elections pretty soon. So this isn't new news. Now, the problem is you can have that idea at the top, but if it doesn't filter down to the states where a lot of these elections are held, they're held in states. If you can't get state leadership and state politicians to buy that, you know, and to translate that message to their local constituencies, then it doesn't work. It doesn't resonate. So you can think tank it, you know, up at the top. You got to get it down to the roots.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, maybe continue this conversation. Also, turn to some of the Republican candidates for governor. We've been talking a lot about the Democrats, but we want to talk about who's running on the Republican side for governor of Connecticut with Colin McEnroe from the Colin McEnroe Show, with Liz Karantowicz, a Republican political analyst, and with Bilal Sakhu from the University of Hartford. You can join us as well in the Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking about the week's news with Bilal Sakhu, who's an associate professor of political science at the University of Hartford. Go Hawks. Liz Karantowicz is here. She's a Republican political analyst. And Colin McEnroe is host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hey, Colin, what's on your show today?
Well, I think this is going to be pretty interesting. Here's the connection that I can make. You know, we can talk about Deval Patrick and Cory Booker and President Obama and their influence on Alabama. We should not forget to mention Sir Charles, who, you know, may have more power.
The round mound of rebound.
Right. And keep in mind, Sir Charles at one point was going to run for governor of Alabama as a Republican.
Right. Wow. That's right.
And his grandmother yelled at him and said that Republicans only care about the rich. And he said, Grandma, I am the rich. But anyway, he was out there today. So basketball is important. Gino Auriemma is going to come in. Gino and I have been talking about doing this for years. We're going to have a conversation today which will not in any way touch upon coaching basketball. It'll be about everything else.
That'll be interesting, and he'll probably have some interesting things to say about politics.
He generally does.
I could only imagine. So Gino Auriemma on the Colin McEnroe Show this afternoon. I don't know. Maybe we can get Sir Charles to call in.
Yeah.
Let's sort of make a connection between what we were just talking about and some of the next things we want to talk about. There was a GOP gubernatorial debate that Liz attended, and we want to talk about that. Some people who know that they're running for governor. What about someone, Colin, who we don't know is running for governor yet? Aaron Stewart, the mayor of New Britain. We were just talking about millennials and how that party needs to maybe think differently about who they attract in the world. Well, Aaron is a millennial, all right.
Right. And there's a piece in The Current today, too, by a millennial talking about the fact that, you know, I mean, you look at the last election, the last national election is this kind of last gasp of some of the oldest baby boomers, two of the oldest baby boomers running it. You can understand why millennials might be tired of everybody looking down their noses at them. So I think Aaron Stewart's a really interesting case. I compared her before to Rafael Devers of the Red Sox, who, you know, is a great prospect and was called up maybe a little bit too early to play third base. But the reason he was called up was because eight other people had failed at third base. And you have a somewhat analogous situation here, you know, where Aaron Stewart, who's the mayor of New Britain, she's, was she 31? Something like that.
She's elected at 26,
she might be,
right?
Yeah, I think she might be 30 going on 31. I can't remember.
So that's really young. On the
you
other hand,
talk about a woman's age, Colin.
Right. it's really young, but you know, I do. She's got a record of sort of conciliatory bipartisanship, fighting that kind of polarization that people don't like very much. She's unlike Luke Bronin, served a term, you know. She can
zing.
Yeah, well, no, I'm sorry. I love Luke Bronin as a person. I think he's a great guy, but you just can't run the way that he's running right now. So I think if she were to get in, and she has trial ballooned this now, there's no question that the balloon's up there. We could talk about some of the practical things that might get in her way. I think she would change the face of this. And maybe I'm wrong about this. I feel like if she could get in and start raising the money, she could become a front runner pretty fast. I think she's very appealing. She's got people vote for people they like.
It's just, yeah, I mean, this goes back to kind of the conversation we were having earlier, which is that candidates make all the difference, right? I mean, you know, I think we're not short mayors in this race, right, on either side. And so, you know, clearly we've got a governor now who was a mayor, and I think, you know, that there's an experience level there where you have to.
I misunderstood what you meant by short mayors.
Oh, that was not a zinger. But the point is, you know, we've got a lot of folks that you know, have had to work with a bipartisan and you know, in a difficult situation and bring people together. And Aaron has certainly done that. You know, look, I mean, there clearly is no front runner on either side. And I think the debate the other night made that evidently clear. And I think, you know, you got to strike while the iron is hot. And if she's got the fire in the belly and she can, you know, see a path to, you know, sort of hit the tactical benchmarks, you know, you got to go for it.
What, I just have to ask you, what's a tactical benchmark?
So, you know, obviously finding a path to raise the qualifying contributions, and, you know, seeing a way to gather the votes, the delegate votes at the convention. And at this point, there's like 100 people that are running. That's a rounding error. But, you know, there's a lot of people who are. So the tactical issue there is you got. You need 15% of the delegates at the convention in order to qualify to be on the primary ballot. And that qualifies you then for the $1.5 million or whatever it is from the state to run your primary campaign. So I think there are, you know, majority of the candidates at this point are all from Fairfield County. So Aaron,
see, I think she could outlier. Get that 50, I think she could get the 15% like nothing. I wouldn't worry about that. But the thing you just said, so many of those other candidates are where the Republican money is. You know, so in terms of raising that qualifying money,
but
you know,
it's mitigated by the fact that they're all only able the quote unquote the money, they're all capped at only writing $100 check.
Yeah.
So the money piece of it is sort of less important at that point because the $100 we've got candidates all over the state that go out and raise the qualifying contributions for their legislative offices. So.
Yeah, Bilal was.
I mean, a couple of things come to mind for me, and I've actually met her several times, and she spoke at the University of Hartford one time on a panel that was organized by the Rail Center, and I like her. I love her energy. I think she's someone who, you know, loves being in the mix and is quite engaging in that sense. I do wonder about her age at this point and how that will go over with folks who she needs to raise money with and people whose confidence within the Republican Party she needs to, you know, to get in order to be able to move her candidacy forward. I think the thing that's intriguing to me about it, I mean, she essentially runs a city which is a Democratic-type city.
Right.
And so her ability to appeal across partisan lines is certainly extraordinary. I do wonder about whether outside of New Britain, whether sort of the name recognition and also the sort of recognition of her governing sort of ability and what she's been able to do in the city, good or bad, whether that will sort of be enough to really bring people on board to support her candidacy.
Sure. Just thinking back to a few years ago at the state convention in 2014, she was tapped by three different people to do their nominating speeches, right? I mean, so, you know, when she was elected, and with good reason, she's got a fiery personality. You know, she pulls no punches and she's authentic and she's compelling. And I think those are things that we need in a candidate. And I think that the rest of the candidates, you know, have their compelling arguments to make and they're energizing their base too. So it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Well, and it might be a rare occasion, Colin. We talk an awful lot about her age and the fact that she got into politics very young. Of course, her dad was the mayor of New Britain. She's been around this for some time. But sometimes in a field filled with, as Liz said, 100 candidates who probably most GOP voters can't pick out of a lineup, being this young woman who people have actually paid attention to might get you more name recognition than, I don't know, being the mayor of some other town.
Right. I think in a normal year she's too young. And if she were running against this is a weird comparison, but I once covered the campaign of Stu McKinney versus John Aristotle Phillips, who was this known as the A-bomb kid. He's this kid who'd been at Princeton and he'd written a term paper about how you could make an atomic bomb out of readily available ingredients. He was very young, but all the celebrities in New York, like Norman Mailer and people like that, were helping on his campaign. But Stu mopped the floor with him because he really was too young. If they had TV appearances together, Stu would crush him. And Stu was kind of lazy, too. He didn't really work very hard. But he was really smart. He knew what he was doing. And John was just too young. And Erin would be too young if she was running against, I don't know, Joe Courtney or Jim Himes, you know, she'd be too young. That would become clear very quickly. Right. But I don't think that's necessarily the case this time around.
And Liz may have a better sense of this. The other thing that I think is problematic for her is that because she's been able to govern in a city like New Britain and she's been able to make the compromise, she's someone who has been able to work with some labor unions and other groups. I just wonder about whether that will allow her to be effective given where the Republican Party is at and the kinds of issues that the Republican Party stands for here in the state, and whether she is a candidate who is really out of step with perhaps many of sort of the core sort of beliefs of the Republican Party. And that I'm not sure of, and you may have a better
sense. Maybe just a couple
of
seconds on that because we got to take a break.
Yeah, I wouldn't say Erin is out of step with the core beliefs of the Republican Party in Connecticut. I think all the things she's done as a mayor, she's been a successful Republican, and that's what we need. That's got to be the standard.
We're going to come back and talk more about some other Republican candidates and some other things we want to address. We're going to spend this break trying to, the three of us, Colin McEnroe, Bilal Sakhu, and myself, trying to convince Liz Karanowitz to stage a run for governor. And we'll do that in a couple
seconds.
We'll
be my lieutenant governor.
But here's what we're going to do right now. We're going to turn it over to a couple colleagues who are going to tell you why you should support everything that you're hearing on WNPR today, not just this program, but Morning Edition and all the other programs. We're here for you, and now you can be here for us. Here's how you can do it. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking about the week's news with Colin McEnroe, who hosts The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, also with Republican political analyst Liz Karanowitz and Bilal Sakhu, who is Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Hartford. We talked a little bit about a candidate who may or may not be a candidate for governor of Connecticut, Erin Stewart, the mayor of New Britain. But there was a GOP gubernatorial debate that you attended, Liz. We've been talking a lot on the show over the last couple of weeks about Democrats who are seeking the governor's office. What did you see in this crew of Republicans who want to take Governor Malloy's job?
I think it was a difficult format. I mean, you have so many candidates, it was difficult for folks to sort of break out. That was sort of my sense. A lot of talking points, but no clear message, right? And so, you know, I still think we walked out of there without a clear front runner. A lot of the scuttlebutt in the room was that Tim Herbst sort of had the floor, that he sort of came away as somebody that folks were talking to, and that was, you know, I don't talk to the folks that are in the room per se, just because a lot of people when it comes to a debate bring their own crew, right? So, you know, a couple hundred people in the room by my estimation. You have to assume that a lot of those people came with candidates and came with sort of an eye towards who they were supporting, probably. So you talk to some of the folks that, you know, there were some police officers there, some onlookers. And so it seemed like Tim sort of resonated with those folks. But I still think when the dynamics of this race, again, you talk about the tactical, you talk about, you know, sort of strategic and operational of this, the process of running. I think there's still clearly room for others to get in. But if they do, they got to get in soon.
even with probably not enough seats on stage in any debate, you still think maybe more candidates could get
into
the race?
I mean, look, I just got a text message asking me to run for governor. I'm seriously thinking about it.
Trying to get the groundswell going. So, I mean, Herbst, I wasn't there, but Herbst appeared to be doing a very familiar thing. I mean, we know what happens when you have too many Republicans on a debate stage, right? The person who can be the most aggressive and maybe even exude a little bit of hostility towards other people on stage tends to dominate the field. That's how Donald
Trump. You know
Trump,
what, though, Colin, yeah. he didn't. Tim was not that way, actually.
Yeah.
I think, you know, he was actually really sort of buttoned up.
All right. Yes, so. I wasn't there. I think the one thing that I'm going to say, and I don't I have no support for this. This is an even more unsupported pundit observation than usual. I've started to think, particularly after last night, about American politics in 2017, 2018 a little bit differently. And one thing that I've begun to wonder is whether the guy in Virginia who's so bland that I'm not sure I remember his name, is it Northam?
Northam.
And Jones, I think people might be interested in kind of no drama candidates. I think they've had enough drama for a while.
I think that's right.
So on both sides, we tend to sort of look for the firebrands and the spitfires and the people, who create a lot of excitement. I'm not sure that's necessarily what's going to win elections in 2018. I think people might be looking for a certain level of sobriety and gravitas and conciliation and comportment.
By the way, we've had that sort of firebrand and hostility here in Connecticut for the last 8 years in Governor Malloy. So I think and clearly his poll numbers reflect a hesitance among Connecticut voters to go that way again. So as I've said over and over again, our candidates need to do a good job of it's not good enough to not be Dan Malloy. They need to go out and make a compelling argument for themselves and not what's wrong, but what's right and where are we going.
Right. I kind of see this a little bit differently than Colin does. I think actually this next governor's race, I think, will be quite intriguing. I had the pleasure or the opportunity about 2 weeks ago to be one of the moderators for the Working Families Party. Mm-hmm. Did a people's symposium in which four of the Democrats who are running for governor were there. And what I was sort of struck by was the way in which they clearly positioned themselves to the left, most of the candidates did, on a range of different issues. And so I think the state is faced with some serious challenges. And I think the vision for where to take the state and to deal with issues around revenue, issues around investment in things like higher education, roads, bridges. There are some real questions here that Connecticut needs to answer. And I think this election coming up, this governor's race, may be one of those kinds of elections in which you will see candidates be sharply divided about what they envision the future of the state is and how to move the state to the place it needs to take. And so from that standpoint, I think it can be anything but bland. I think these candidates, with so many of them out there in the field, need to really stand out. And
right.
Need
I
to
don't
position
think the ideas
themselves.
Have
yeah.
to be bland, but I right. think the deportment yeah. of the candidates oh. – I'm really talking more about that. What were you going to say?
Yeah, I think you're right in terms of, we're in a crisis here and the time for rainbows and unicorns is far gone, right? I mean, mm-hmm. we need somebody who's going to look at this. We have to prioritize. Mm-hmm. There are some things we can afford and there are some things we can't. And we need somebody that's going to show that they're going to be able to get in a room with legislators from both sides of the aisle and work together to get something done, mm-hmm. right? I think people are desperate for what the Republicans and the Democrats and the legislature did this last with the compromise budget, flawed as it may or may not be, they want people to work together. They're not getting that in Washington, and that's what makes state legislatures and state houses around the country much different, frankly, than Washington, because they work together. And I think people are going to want to see candidates that can do that.
And we spend a lot of our time, obviously, talking about Washington for a lot of reasons. But, what goes on at the state level and in terms of how it impacts the day-to-day lives of people, it's really where these fights, are at and
That's
where
exactly
they should
right,
be.
Yeah.
And I think, I think this race will be an incredibly interesting race because I think of the challenges, as you point out, the state faces.
Yeah, I'll just sort of refine my previous comments a little bit and just say, some of the candidates that maybe I've been a little bit dismissive of, I'm kind of rethinking. And so, a candidate like Jonathan Harris, who's a very likable guy and he's been around for a while and he knows the issues pretty well, if he can put together a platform of ideas per Bilal, that really speak to voters, I'll go over on the Republican side. One guy I hear a lot of nice things about, I don't really know that much about him, but a guy like Mike Handler or maybe even David Walker, these are the guys that are, they're a little bit white bread. They're on the verge of maybe being a little bit boring. But once again, if they can put together some ideas and conduct themselves like adults, which I think is maybe one of their strengths, maybe you've got a better candidate than I would have said 2 or 3 weeks ago when I was a little bit more conventionally focused on sizzle.
Sure. I think Handler, you make a good point. Mike Handler from Stanford I think he was another standout just on substance and an ability for an outsider to come in and show that you know they have a command of some of the issues that we're facing. But I do think we need a candidate that's going to excite people, particularly on our side, because we've got a registration deficit. We've got we need people that are going to be able to get our grassroots right. excited and get unaffiliated voters excited. And I think our deficit has always been on that emotional piece, right? I mean, we have good ideas and look at Mitt Romney, but you need to compel people emotionally to come to the table and say, that person is going to lead. And I think that lead is a verb, and we're in desperate need of that right now.
I just want to quickly turn to, and Colin had mentioned this earlier and in previous weeks, you personally like Mayor Luke Bronin of Hartford. He's trying to turn things around there, but he hasn't served an entire term. You think that's not a great platform for him to start a gubernatorial campaign, then he sort of gets out of the gate with an exploratory committee and immediately has a little bit of an issue sending an email, a fundraising email to about 50 city school employees. He's apologized for this, but it's the sort of mix-up that we would normally be spending a lot of time talking about when you can't get that one little thing right.
Yeah, well, you know, as Liz's generation says, I can't even. and I
you left me out of that, Colin. Colin, what's you know, you okay? I'm nearly a millennial.
All right, so
I am not a millennial.
All right. Okay, all right, thank you.
I made a mistake, which is like one of my rules in life is don't like politicians. Just evaluate them in the most critical way that you can. And I really have liked Luke Bronin a lot. I like his wife, too. I think they're great, interesting, exciting people. But, I mean, I really feel like he's kneecapped himself not only as a candidate for governor. I think this is a very implausible thing to do, to run midway into your first term when you vowed not to do that and you don't have big successes to show from midway through your first term. And then you make a mistake like this. I think the question, I mean, I just think he's just not going to go anywhere as a gubernatorial candidate. The question is, can he mayor anymore? I mean, can he mayor? Because, I mean, he now has, in a way, shown the city that his commitment to Hartford is not 100%. That's going to be a big problem.
Lead is a verb, and now mayor is a verb. Bilal, a quick thought?
I wanted to try that out.
I mean, you know, certainly I think, you know, and Colin mentioned this during the break, you know, govern at least one term. And if you haven't done that and created that record of sort of leadership, I find it difficult to imagine how you jump to the next level when you haven't sort of demonstrated at any level just yet your ability to get things done. And Hartford's got many challenges that it need a governor, I'm not a governor, but a mayor who will be quite focused on trying to solve.
Yeah, I mean, it's not unheard of for candidates to say one thing to win votes and then do something else when they get into office. And I think, you know, Governor Malloy has shown that over and over and over again. And I don't think anybody is surprised that Mayor Bronin is following suit.
I want to quickly turn to something you drew attention to, Bilal, and it gets to some of the big structural issues that we're talking about here. Of all the problems that Connecticut faces, this intractable budget problem, it always seems to get bigger. We've got problems with transportation infrastructure, energy infrastructure, but we've got some demographic challenges as well. Not entirely bad news, right, though. What did you read in some of the latest demographic looks at what Connecticut looks like now and into the future?
You know, certainly, you know, when you look at the state and the changing demographics of the state, Connecticut is becoming more racially and ethnically diverse. And I think that will create some interesting opportunities and also some interesting challenges for our state. You know, the article we were referring to out of The Current also talked about millennials not having children. And so as much, at least early on, and delaying having children. But I think in general, these demographic changes really present some interesting questions. A lot of, you know, these folks will be, the cities are expected to grow, where some of the suburbs and then particularly areas like Fairfield County losing population somewhat, I think will have an impact on the tax structure in our state where wealth is concentrated at that makes it into the coffers for the state. But I think in particular in our central cities, places like Hartford and New Haven and Waterbury, the Open Communities Alliance recently put out a report that talked about sort of opportunity areas and where people of color tend to be concentrated in those areas with the lowest kinds of opportunities. And I think many of our cities are those places. And certainly housing, residential segregation contributes to that. And so I just sort of wonder about what that future looks like for a state in which we've got to do much better than we're doing with providing equal educational opportunities for children in central cities and also rural areas, and also opportunities for jobs and employment into the future, making sure that our higher ed system is the kind of system it needs to be in the state in order to really respond to these changing trends in the state.
And doing all those things while we're trying to cut a big budget deficit, Colin.
Right. And so that when you're doing that, you can't fix the things that need to be fixed to make the good outcomes happen. And I'll just pick on one because I know we're short on time. Transportation is a big driver in this. You know, either you can get people to and from cities in an effective way, or you can't make them thrive as business centers. I was interested in the fact that Manchester was singled out as another smaller city that may grow very quickly.
Right.
It's a very different kind of city. But in a way, these edge cities may do better just because we don't have I know we're going to get better train service, but I don't know if that's enough.
Liz, a thought on this? I mean, demographics and what it means, not just for your party, but for the state as well, these changes.
Well, I think, you know, Bilal put it quite succinctly, sort of what the opportunities and the challenges are going to be. And I think as our elected leaders are looking at, you know, sort of where prioritizing again, you know, we're in a very tight budget situation. We can barely afford the government we have. I would argue we can't afford the government we have. And so we're going to have to do a better job of creating partnerships and empowering our communities to serve their communities and you know, help to build stronger opportunities for everybody across the state.
As we close out, and Colin, we just have a couple seconds yet. Tomorrow marks the fifth anniversary of the Sandy Hook shooting, in which 20 children and 6 educators were killed there. We don't really have time to go into much depth. What does this date mark for you? What do you think about it?
You and I spent that day together, and we were on the air for an awful lot of time. And I think it's a scar that doesn't heal. I mean, we may move on in terms of news and stuff like that, but obviously for the people in Newtown, it's a scar that doesn't heal. And I really think for a lot of us, who, if you looked at this closely, it's something you will never get over, and you never should get over it.
I just want to say quickly before we head to break, I've been thinking an awful lot about the people who have been trying to turn their communities and their lives around, people like my friends, the Greens, who have raised so much money for the Anna Grace Project, the people who are raising money for behavioral research. And we have a story coming up tomorrow about a group that's putting together an animal sanctuary in town in memory of one of the little girls who was killed. There's an awful lot of good that is being done, and I wish for all of those families and all those who are touched by this tragedy the most joy and peace we can possibly have going into a very difficult time and a very difficult holiday season, I'm sure, for them. I want to thank our guests today, Liz Karantowicz, who's a Republican political analyst. Always good to see you, Liz. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks to Bilal Sakhu, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Hartford. Bilal, thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show. Gino Auriemma on the show today. Colin?
Yes, and thank you, Mr. Dankowski.
And our technical producers, Kion Wolf. Katie Tolarski is our executive producer. Here are some folks to tell you how you can support everything you hear on WNPR. Thanks.